You're
you in 30 years.
Whoa.
Some advice. Open a Laurel Road checking account. When you refinance your student loans, you could get a rate as low as 1.37% variable APR, plus a cash bonus.
I can do that.
Also, don't date Parker.
Ew, the defense attorney?
Trust me.
Save yourself with Laurel Road. Visit laurelroad.com/saveyourself for more information. Rates depend on your credit profile and include discounts. Terms and conditions apply. Laurel Road is a brand of KeyBank, member FDIC.
The Black Doctors Podcast highlights the stories of minority professionals with the goal of inspiring others. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and share with others, because the next generation can't be what they don't see. Tune in every Monday to hear our stories told by us.
Hello and welcome back to the Black Doctors Podcast. I'm Steven, your host. This week, I'm so excited to share an incredibly awesome field and individual, Dr. Yolando Austin II. He has earned a doctorate in education as well as his MBA. He is a registered respiratory therapist as well as a certified anesthesiologist assistant. He currently works as the program director for the Nova Southeastern University Certified Anesthesiologist Assistant Program, the Tampa location. Dr. Austin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's a mouthful of words and acronyms following your name, so we definitely got to start. Tell us about yourself and where your journey through this educational process started.
Right. So initially, I started out at an HBCU. I attended Florida A&M University, and I did that for just a few years or a couple of years. And, of course, later transferred out to another university. My major at the time at Florida A&M University was pre-nursing, and then I went over to the University of Central Florida in Orlando, and my major was cardiopulmonary sciences. So I graduated with a bachelor's degree in cardiopulmonary sciences. From there, my plan was probably very similar to most people who listen to this podcast, in that I wanted to go to medical school. And so my considerations at the time were medical school, pharmacy, and pretty much that was it. So I began working as a respiratory therapist and simultaneously completing the remainder of my coursework that would be necessary for med school. And it was at that particular time where there was a colleague of mine, a fellow respiratory therapist, and he actually told me about this new program he had never heard of. He took the MCAT, and because he took the MCAT, he received this information about this new program. He told me about it, anesthesiologist assistant program. So I said, hey, I've not completed any medical school applications yet. I've not taken the MCAT exam. I said, let me just see what this is about. So I did my research, and that was pretty much where I was sold. It was, 8 years of school, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency plus for an anesthesiologist, which is the area that I wanted to go into, versus 4 years of school for pharmacy and 27 months for the anesthesiologist assistant program. So essentially at that point, considering I had a family, I was married, got married pretty young, it was an easy sell. I did my research, I looked into it, the cost of the education, everything about it, and I was sold.
Yeah, let's dig a little deeper, because there's so many, I guess looking back, this podcast is pretty much mostly about careers. Respiratory therapy, how did you get into that career pathway?
So, well, I knew as a kid, very, very young, that I wanted to go into medicine. And again, I'm pretty sure that's probably the majority of the people who find this podcast. But for me, it was medicine and nothing else. And respiratory therapy was just something that I kind of transitioned to. It was initially, as I mentioned, my major was nursing, and I was going to go to nursing school and become a nurse and then go from there. But my mother at the time, she actually had applied to a respiratory therapy program, and she mentioned it to me, so that when I left from Florida A&M University, again, it was one of those situations. I did a little bit of research. I like the cardiopulmonary focus of it. And so that's kind of how I got into respiratory therapy. But even going into respiratory therapy, and it's a great profession, I always knew that it was just going to be essentially a transition to something else. So it never was intended to be you know, the finality of my professional career.
Yeah. And to become a respiratory therapist, you took courses, or was it on the job training and certification exams?
Yes. So in order to become a registered respiratory, well, there's two different types of respiratory therapists. There's a certified respiratory therapist, which, you know, they have programs as short as, well, they did in the past. As far as I'm concerned now, they've done away with those programs, but they did have some that were about a year and a half program. But to become a registered respiratory therapist, it requires a 4-year degree. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I think the minimum was a 2-year degree. But again, most individuals who wanted to become a respiratory therapist, registered respiratory therapist, did go on and complete their 4-year degree. So it does require a lot of, not the same amount of coursework, pre-med coursework for medical school, but a lot of similarities in that actual coursework. And of course, at the culmination of the program, you have to sit for your board exam. There are two different exams. There's a CRT exam, and then there's a RRT exam.
So in the middle of doing that, which is incredibly relevant for your current career, you're working with the cardiopulmonary systems, manipulating ventricular tubes and other breathing devices and modalities. Your colleague told you about the certified anesthesiologist assistant. You did your research. And where did you go for that program?
So at the time that this information was passed on to me, the thing I'll have to mention is that the CAA, and I'll just use that abbreviation moving forward so that I don't have to say certified anesthesiologist assistant the entire time. But the CAA profession is relatively young. The first program was developed in 1969, and there was essentially minimal growth in the profession from that time to the time in which I applied, which was 2006, right? So there were only three programs in the nation at that time.
Wow.
And Nova Southeastern University, they had put together what essentially became the fourth program in the entire profession. So there were four programs at the point in which I made this decision to move forward with the profession. And Nova was ironically the only program located in Florida. So they were the only program in Florida, and they were the very first program in Florida. Of course, since then, there's been a significant amount of growth. So that's pretty much where that decision came from. And, you know, after I did my research and I looked into it, there were some limitations within the profession, clearly. But I think the positives and the draw and the benefits did outweigh any negatives, specifically for my situation.
Yeah, and possibly the application process has changed, but since you do work in the field as an educator, how do you apply to become a CAA?
Okay, so essentially what the same pre-med coursework that one would need to get into medical school is what's required for this profession, right? So all the chemistries and anatomy and biologies and, you know, these types of things, those are the same courses that are required actually to be accepted into this profession. Following that, we also expect that those who apply to the program have three letters of recommendation. And this is all things that I had to do at the same time where I had applied many, many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Three letters of recommendation. There's a choice to take either the MCAT or the GRE, and of course, the bachelor's degree. And it doesn't have to be in a specified concentration, but you do have to complete the necessary pre-med coursework.
And you started this 27-month program. Can you kind of, well, first, let's start by breaking down what a CAA is.
Right. So there are three different types of anesthesia care providers that are approved to be able to render your anesthesia, if you will. Of course, you know, the anesthesiologist, the certified registered nurse anesthetist, or CRNA, and then the third profession is the profession that I'm a part of, which is the CAA profession. Right. So, and there are more similarities as far as the educational pathway is concerned between the CAA and the CRNA. Now, of course, that conversation can go in a whole lot of different ways, but I think for the sake of missing politics and staying focused, we'll just move forward to say that, you know, there's a lot of similarities between what CAAs do in practice and what the CRNA is expected to do in practice.
In practice, you know, what do you do as a CAA?
Yeah, so essentially we provide anesthesia in its entirety. So I would say that the job description of the CAA is pretty close to that of the CRNA, which is also pretty close to that of the anesthesiologist. And the only difference is that we are a part of the anesthesia care team model, and so we work under the supervision of the anesthesiologist. So an anesthesiologist can supervise, you know, anywhere from 1 to 4 rooms of mid-level anesthesia care providers, that being either CRNAs or CAAs.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we, you know, everything from induction, maintenance, emergence, peripheral nerve blocks, regional anesthesia, I mean, you name it. The entire gamut of perioperative patient care, essentially, is what the CAA is expected to be able to do.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. So when you started your program for those 27 months, you know, how is that program broken down and structured?
So the program itself is a 27-month program, but the first year is essentially purely didactic, right? And the premise behind that is that we essentially want to make sure that the student gets a pretty solid foundation of, you know, all of the didactics before they ever step foot into the clinical arena. So there's 27 months. The first 12 months, 12 to 14 months, are purely didactic with very little clinical. However, the last year is essentially purely clinical. And if there are any didactics, it's very, very, very minimal.
And do you go through different rotations when you get to the clinical portion?
So there are, well, one of the things that we do is every single one of the students in the program, we're tracking their case logs and we're tracking their number of hours completed, their clinical hours. So we essentially have a minimum that every single student has to complete in every subspecialty of anesthesia. So, mm-hmm. you know, your cardiac anesthesia, trauma anesthesia, pediatric anesthesia, neuroanesthesia, all of these subspecialties, we have to complete so many cases and so many hours in each of these subspecialties before we can even complete the program. So that entire second year, we're switching locations. And of course, we have clinical sites throughout the entire U.S. And actually, believe it or not, we do have a few international sites.
Oh, wow.
Now, of course, considering COVID, we've had to kind of fall back and not utilize them as we would like to, but we still do have those affiliation agreements, and we hope to get back to using them. So essentially, yeah, that's what the curriculum looks like. This kind of a snapshot of the curriculum is that, you know, first year didactic, very little clinical, second year clinical, very little didactic, completing all subspecialties of anesthesia, targeting a specified number of hours, specified number of clinical cases.
And that produces a well-rounded anesthesia provider that's ready to go out and practice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, if I'm speaking about my program specifically, then the program statistics definitely show that we put out a good product. Everyone gets jobs. Job placement is 100%. Board exam pass rate is 100%. First time pass rate.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, attrition, of course, you know, we're like most other AA programs, and we just try to make sure that we keep with under 10% attrition. And I think most of the AA programs do that.
Gotcha. So as you were finishing up your program, you went out, you found a job. Can you kind of describe what a typical day or typical week was like for you and your practice?
So typically what I would do, and actually I currently do, though I'm the director of the Tampa anesthesiology assistant program with NOVA. I also practice, and I'm contracted with two different groups here in the Florida area, Tampa, Florida area. So, you know, we come in the morning. Of course, we would find out what our assignment is. So, you know, I'm sure every one of these facilities, they have a board. We find out what our caseload would look like. From there, we would go and set up our room, make sure we get our, you know, anesthesia drugs, anesthesia cart, all of that set up, our airway equipment set up, check the machines and things like that, come out and pre-op the patient, or basically have a conversation preoperatively with that patient in preparation for the anesthesia. And then we would, now, of course, the anesthesiologist is on board and they're knowledgeable about essentially all of these things. They've seen the patient as well. And when we're ready to go into the room, we go bring the patient back, prepare that patient for induction. And technically at this particular point in time, we're supposed to call the anesthesiologist. Right now, there's a lot of, you know, points that I can mention there as far as whether they would come or whether they would not come once they're called. But that's the way the profession is carried out, that it's intended that we call the supervising anesthesiologist. They come in for induction, which is getting the patient off to sleep essentially. And then they're right out the door and we're monitoring the patient throughout the entire surgical procedure and then wake the patient up in the end. So we emerge the patient and then drop them off to recovery.
Gotcha. And in the typical kind of workload, are you working 40-hour weeks, 60-hour weeks, less, more, whatever you want?
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the benefits of the profession is that there's so much flexibility in schedule. I always say this is probably one of the most attractive things about this profession specifically is that, yeah, I'd say the majority of CAAs work 40-hour work weeks, but there's plenty of opportunity for overtime. There's a lot of opportunity to have like a specified schedule, whether it's like working, you know, 5 8-hour shifts or 4 10-hour shifts or 3 13-hour shifts or you name it, it's all out there. When I initially graduated, I went and worked for an anesthesia group in Clearwater, Florida. And my schedule at the time was 3 days a week, 13.5-hour shifts, which essentially gave me 4 days off to be able to do whatever I like to do. Now, if you think about that, an individual can pick up an entire separate job if they wanted to, right? Wow. And we're already compensated well for the basic, you know, 40-hour work week. But in theory, you could go and pick up a second job, or you could work, you know, significant amount of overtime. I mean, the options are just limitless.
So, Yolando, in addition, though, to becoming a CAA, you at some point earned a doctorate of education.
Right.
And an MBA. So where did those come into the picture?
So basically I graduated, my program started in 2006. I finished in 2008. Okay. And as I mentioned, I went to work for an anesthesia group that covered major hospitals in Clearwater, Florida. Now at the time, that was 2008, there was discussion of Nova Southeastern University opening up a second program. Right. So the primary location was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which is the program that I graduated from. But there was discussion of them opening a Tampa program. And at that particular time, though I was working clinically, he's now the chair of the department. But at that particular time, he was just the program director. He asked if I would be willing to, you know, help out by teaching some courses for the program. He knew that I had a background as a RRT. And, you know, so I said, hey, I'd consider it. So fast forward into June of 2009, that's when the first class started in Tampa. So I initially was onboarded and I started teaching right at the beginning of this program's inception. Now, part of that process of, you know, joining this institution as faculty meant that I was able to take advantage of some of the benefits offered. And one of the major benefits was the 100% tuition waiver.
Mm.
So immediately, you know, when I finished my AA training, my initial plan was, okay, you know, I've finished this CAA program. I'm doing well. I'm very, you know, sharp in perioperative patient management. I said, but I think, you know, now's a good time to go back to that original idea of mine and perhaps go to medical school. So medical school was, again, in the back of my mind. But then this opportunity had come up, and it was one I couldn't pass up. It was one that, you know, I didn't have any passion for teaching, I would say, at that particular moment, or at least I didn't know I did. But it was something that I told myself, I said that I absolutely needed to give it an opportunity, give it a try. So I did that. And I think that just ended up being probably one of the best decisions that I've ever made, just
really,
because of all things that followed thereafter. I mean, for me, I was never one of those kids that said, you know, I absolutely have to be a physician, right? I just knew I wanted to practice in medicine. And I felt like, you know, utilizing the maximum amount of what I could offer would be that I would go to medical school, right? But, you know, this proved to be, I would say, a better option for me, especially. And then, you know, of course, then providing for the 100% tuition waiver and paying for my doctorate, it gave that doctor title, if that was ever a concern. And then, again, they paid for my MBA, 100% tuition waiver.
Yeah, so win. And again, goes to show the variety of specialties and types of work that the healthcare professions represent. I am curious, so the student became the teacher. So as a faculty member and the program director, can you talk a little bit about what you've seen and how you've seen this career change and anything that you think would help future CAA students?
So I would say that, you know, when I started in this profession, it was back in 2006, and there was a lot of limitations, right? I would say at the time, CAAs only practiced in maybe 10 states at that time, right? Which is, if we're being honest, that's a pretty significant limiting factor.
Yeah.
So that was what I walked into. And four programs, maybe 10 states. If you fast forward to now, there are about 14 accredited programs, and CAAs can practice in upwards of about 18 or 19 states, right? We've got Guam, which is also included in there. So I say 18 or 19. So that's probably the most significant change that I've seen. But the other areas where I've seen clear change and positive growth is in what the programs offer to the students. Hmm. When I was a student, we had this one little tiny lab, and all of our training for all of the entire class, it was a class of 30 students, was held in this particular tiny little lab all at the same time, pretty much, right? So not broken down into smaller, more manageable groups. There was a lot of equipment that was missing, so we had to kind of self-simulate different types of areas of anesthesia. Fast forward to now, and I wish you had an opportunity to visit our school, you would see it's so amazing. We have these high fidelity simulators, which they function exactly what you would expect to see in a patient. This is exactly the way these things operate. So we actually inject drugs into them. They respond to the drugs as a real human would. We can make them cry, scream, everything. We can adjust their breathing to, you know, account for different types of perioperative patient concerns or different types of events that can happen intraoperatively. We have a regional anesthesia lab. So Whereas when I was a student, they didn't teach. I mean, we barely got any training on spinals, epidurals, you know, definitely not ultrasound guided regional anesthesia because it just had not grown that much in popularity up to that point. But now we have an entire lab built out specifically for training ultrasound guided regional anesthesia techniques. We also use the ultrasound machines that we have on campus for vascular access and training of that. Task trainers for epidurals and spinals and things of that nature. So again, the tools and modalities used to train the students today significantly far better than what I had when I was in my training.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And sounds like there's been an incredible amount of growth in the field as well as in the way CAAs are being educated.
Right, for sure.
So what would you say to that college student that's out there, knows they want to work in healthcare, probably hasn't heard of a CAA before listening to this episode, but you know they're on the fence, might be interested. What would you say to that person?
I would say that, you know, some people know right from the start, right from the beginning, that they want to be a physician, right? And for those particular students, I would say there is only one choice. There's only one option, and that's medical school. But if it's for any other reason, or if becoming a physician is not, you know, maybe if it doesn't hold the same merit or the same desire as maybe it once did when you were younger or before you started your academic career, things of that nature, then I would suggest that you consider physician extenders, whether that is a PA or whether that is an anesthesiologist assistant. I think they're both really, really phenomenal options. Now, again, I think that comes down to what your desire and your passion is, because I always say the same thing. I oftentimes will have a student who will say, hey, you know, Dr. Austin, I'm considering this program. I'm going to take, you know, should I take the MCAT or does that look better than me taking the GRE? And my response is always, well, is there any part of you that wants to become a physician? Because if the answer is yes, then you would only obviously take the MCAT so that you can cover both bases. But aside from that, you know, just get exposure, you know, go out, do some shadowing. Take the opportunity to kind of, you know, be a part of the perioperative environment, see what physician extenders do in anesthesia, talk to a lot of them. And, you know, one of the things that I hear, and, you know, I hope this doesn't come off the wrong way, is that you can ask any CAA, you can ask any of them. And I've never met a CAA that regretted his decision to go into the profession. But I've heard of a lot of people who've applied to our program who've, you know, done some various shadowing of different types of specialties for medical school and becoming a physician that said, you know, they were either guided by the physician that said, hey, you know, if I could do it all over again, I'd do it differently. And I'd consider CAA or some that just seemed quite miserable and the choice of their profession. Now, that's not everyone. Of course, you know, there are, you know, great physicians who love what they do. I think the majority of them are. But equally, and I'm sure no one would dispute that there are some that don't seem very happy.
Burnout is real.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing, you know.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Austin, thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, I have been actually looking high and low to find a CAA to come and talk. And one of the students online, I think is Anesthesia AL, she pointed me in your direction. I'm so excited that she did and was able to pick your brain. You obviously have a wealth of information, especially including the fact that you are a program director for Nova Southeastern University, the Tampa campus. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing this incredible field of medicine, because representation matters.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And you know, again, I hope just to offer exactly what you said, just a piece, a small bit of information that, you know, maybe one or two or three or 10 people might say, hey, I think that's probably worth looking into. It's probably something I'd be interested in. And I can just tell, if I'm speaking to those individuals, I can tell them specifically that this has been the best decision I've made in my life. And I say that because it has afforded me the opportunity to be able to do some other things, you know, other things in preparation for, you know, potentially generating significant passive income and the opportunity to retire early and things of that nature, because I have less debt and more time and things like that. So again, it's not for everyone, but I think it does appeal to a certain mass or a certain group of people. And it is definitely worth looking into. But again, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And we'll include some links. I mean, you can Google Nova Southeastern University, but we'll put the links in the show notes as well, so you can begin to read about some of these programs and start your research if you're so inclined.
The Black Doctors Podcast is a nonprofit, volunteer passion project with the goal of inspiring all who listen. Tune in next week for another episode of the Black Doctors Podcast with Dr. Stephen Bradley, your friendly neighborhood anesthesiologist.